Please be seated. So it took a little bit longer because I understand you guys are talking about expert conferencing and scheduling of witnesses and timing, and yeah, which is why I'm not doing this job and Mr. Cooper is doing this job. It does present challenges, doesn't it? Yeah, which is, you know, hence, you know, we were trying to block it out in a court break period.
Yes, and witnesses, I think, had made arrangements in relation to everything else going on around the country for that window. So we're doing what we can to have that caucusing run as soon as it can from this point on, but noting there are some availability challenges, which we will continue working through.
Okay, all right.
Now, just before the tea break, there was a discussion around the production of some further information in relation to which of the catchments shown on the deemed permits report that goes to the Minister are also covered by a minimum flow in Schedule 2A of the plan.
That's certainly part of it, yeah.
That part of it can be done relatively quickly and easily, and it's probably already been done and will be produced from the consents team leader with her evidence, so it'll come through in that form. The second question, or the second element in relation to whether the catchments where there is overlap, whether the permits are already compliant with those minimum flows, is a far more complicated question. And if you think about the example given where the Falls Dam is controlling the minimum flows, it may well be that there's a control taking place that's not captured, for example, on each and every deemed permit that might be further downstream. So that
a control taking place, sorry?
Sorry,
you said a control taking place.
Oh, a control by virtue of a condition on a permit further downstream. So it's not just an exercise of looking at each of the deemed permits within a particular catchment and checking whether each of them has a minimum flow recorded on each permit, because one permit might be controlling the minimum flow for the entire catchment or a part of a catchment. So I'm told that that exercise just isn't a straightforward exercise to do, unfortunately, which perhaps highlights the risks associated with whether the rules accommodate Schedule 2A minimum flow or not.
So part of the issue in this case is that in some ways some parties' evidence is presented using Manahere Kia as an example, and perhaps Tairi to a certain extent, as if everything is fine there, whatever fine means in terms of minimum flow, therefore these provisions can apply or reject the plan change, or therefore these provisions. And it's like, well, it might be fine there, but is it fine in every other catchment? I don't know. We're just a little blind, and maybe we're wanting too much information, but, you know, we have this, there is an element of uncertainty that we have in relation to the relief being pursued by some parties.
And the convenient response is to say that the onus is on those parties, but the reality is the council has the type of information that they might be seeking to rely upon, and the council staff are looking to produce where they readily can produce that information when it's been requested and where it can usefully assist. But this question over, well, what happens in the other Schedule 2A catchments outside of Manahere Kia and Tairi? That's a complex question, and perhaps highlighting some of the challenges with including those restrictions within the planning framework.
That's exactly so. But we're getting closer to what the nub of the problem is in terms of the problem that we're working on. Is it process, or is it environmental, or is it both? Now, your witness says process, but it's, to me, it's plainly these provisions are plainly looking at working on both, and so we'll see whether that should be so. And, you know, obviously parties have quite divergent views.
Yes, and I think we just need to see how that plays out over the next little while.
So I'm not sure where that takes us in terms of, yeah, and again, with the spatial relationship between your FMUs and the catchments, it's not clear. Possibly that evidence is in, you know, 5,000 pages of documents out there. I don't know. But, I mean, it's actually, you know, that was one of the reasons for bringing forward those regulatory folk. They'd be able to, you know, set the scene.
Yes, so they are producing a series of maps showing spatially the extent of permits still outstanding, those in process and those that have been processed to assist with the spatial understanding of the permits and train and those to come.
So you've got deemed permits, you've got replacement water consents, and then you've actually got, you know, I guess that baseline permits which are out there which are not up for renewal in any sense. And so, and then into the mix you might have minimum flows, either in Schedule 2 or actually you might have minimum flows because that's what Policy 6412 says you should have. I've no idea whether that's being implemented.
Yes, again, one of the maps that's been worked on is showing simply by coloured dot permits that have a minimum flow versus those that don't have a minimum flow imposed on them. So, again, you'll be able to see spatially just what the spread is, and having looked at drafted that, there are dots of different colours, so there's a mix. And I haven't drilled in to see whether there's a consistent pattern within particular FMUs or catchments yet, but hopefully that information will start to assist in terms of the current state of affairs.
Yeah, so it's an implementation or plan question, really. You've got lots of policies about minimum flows. Are they being implemented? And can they be implemented? We've got an answer on the can with deemed permits, but for everything else, were they being implemented? And maybe the answer there was also, if you can't implement for one, it's not much point implementing for the other. So actually, minimum flows and allocation blocks are not implemented. And, you know, if that's the case, we just need to know that and therefore know what the hydrology is.
Well, again, the consent planners will be able to assist just with their direct experience having been processing applications under now both regimes for a little while.
Okay.
That was all. Thank you.
Righto.
Thank you, ma'am. Right. Only 10 more minutes.
Yep.
Done. Right. I'd like to move on to the non-complying policy now. And I'm, again, looking at Mr. Farrell's marked-up version. And as I understand it, the purpose of this policy is twofold, and I want you to tell me if I'm correct or not. One is it's to act as a disincentive for people to even try and go through the non-complying consent pathway.
Are you referring to policy 10A23?
Yes.
Yep.
Thanks. So as I read it, there's two reasons for this policy. One is to act as a stick, as a disincentive for people to go through the non-complying pathway. And the other, if they do choose to go through the non-complying pathway, is to put in place a precautionary policy direction to protect the environmental outcomes that might come from such a consent.
Correct, as well as give direction around consent duration.
And duration. So three purposes then.
Yep.
Disincentive, but if you come here, precautionary environmental test, and still strong direction as to short consent duration. Sorry. You have to say yes.
Yes.
That's right. then when you evaluated the proposal that has been put up based on the evidence of Dr. Hayes and then reflected in Mr. Farrell's evidence, you've addressed that in your reply evidence at paragraph 150.
That is correct. I assume so. Yes. I definitely addressed it.
You did. And in your paragraph 150A, one of the reasons you currently don't support the proposal is in the third sentence of paragraph A, you say, the amendments recommended by Ms. McIntyre and Mr. Farrell could prevent water takes with less than minor or de minimis adverse effects from getting consent for more than 6 years.
Correct. That was my interpretation of reading the table recommended by Mr. Farrell.
Mm.
I came to that conclusion when I considered the allocation rate. In under the row that refers to allocation rate,
mm-hmm.
He sets a certain threshold, 20% of flow allocation, or 30%, 25% in some cases. I interpreted that, but that is actually one of the things that I wasn't 100% sure about, but I assume that it will refer to the aggregate of all the consents within or from that water body. Is that a correct assumption?
Well, that's possibly a drafting issue, isn't it?
Yeah. If he relies on the table from Dr. Hayes, Hayes sets those thresholds, considering the combined allocation from all the consents.
Yes.
So I assume that that is the rationale that is applied up here as well.
Yes.
And so in that case, if that becomes a threshold, the state of the water body in terms of allocation becomes the determinant,
mm-hmm.
not the effects of the activity. Because you might have an activity with a negligible effect that wouldn't be granted consent because of this.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of changed the intent as to what was initially proposed in the plan change proposal.
I was just going to say, if there was a consent that had an application that had a negligible effect, there is still the alternative non-complying pathway, though, isn't there, under section 104 capital D subpara A, that if effects minor or less, it doesn't matter if you're contrary to the policy to get through that non-complying gateway. There's still a consenting pathway to be assessed on the merits, isn't there?
That is correct, yes.
Yeah. So yeah. That really takes away your first concern in subparagraph A, doesn't it?
That is correct,
yeah. Okay. And then your other concern in subparagraph B that you've articulated is that the thresholds rely on the hydrological parameters.
Correct.
And you've got a concern that some of those might be problematic to calculate in terms of uncertainties.
There are some uncertainties. To give you an example, when we started looking at the naturalized melt of the Manuharikia, some of the initial figures had a margin of error of 500 litres per second, which is not a small volume of water. So that was where I was coming from. In relation to the Tari, you might have the same issue based on the current available information held by ORC to determine what is the naturalized melt.
Although that wasn't the impression we got from Mr. Henderson on Monday, was it? When these questions were put to him, his evidence was more certain than the concern that you're expressing.
It would be possible, my understanding from Mr. Henderson is that it would be possible to come up with a regional model based on a refined national model that applies to the Tari, but in the Tari as well, he pointed, if I recollect well, to the complexities of the hydrology there as a result of modification due to water taking and in some cases releases from Logan Burn as well.
Okay. All right. And then finally, on this point again, so you've obviously read the evidence of Dr. Hayes.
Yes.
And as you will be familiar with, his recommendations, if I just take you to, say, his paragraph 107.
Mm-hmm.
And so the section that I've taken you to is a more comprehensive discussion and the explanation of where he's come to with the table. But at 107 he refers to the document that was prepared in support of a draft NES for flows and levels. And you've also referenced that document, I think, in your evidence in chief at your paragraph 65.
Yep.
So you're familiar with that as well. And Dr. Alibone referred to it as the 2008 Becker report.
Correct.
Which represented I think his words were, I'll say it represents a consensus of a set of experts that were engaged to help prepare the report for the Ministry for the Environment. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding.
And Dr. Hayes also, later in his evidence in chief, refers to an additional report, the Richter et al. Report. It is paragraph 115, which is an international review of scientific research on the same issue in terms of setting flow thresholds.
I can recall that Dr. Hayes referred to that, but I'm not familiar with that report.
Now, obviously, we will get to see Dr. Hayes' evidence on these flow thresholds and what they protect and what they don't protect. I expect there'll be some testing of that, so I'm not asking you to second-guess the outcome of that. But should those thresholds hold up, and should we be able to rely on them as setting a precautionary threshold, doesn't that make this policy clearer and more directive in terms of achieving that precautionary limb that we discussed?
Well, it's a point that has been raised before. Putting in quantifiable thresholds will probably help to clarify what are no more than minor adverse effects. On some values, I'm not sure whether they can apply to all the values that are relevant for that water body. I'm also not a hydrologist, so I don't know what the applicability is across all the water bodies. The guidelines make reference to distinction between water bodies smaller than 5 cubic meters or more. But I think it would be in my personal opinion, I think it is definitely worthwhile considering applying that in at least some circumstances. I'm happy to kind of participate in that. I just had a few more questions as well when looking at the evidence of Mr. Farrell. What if you cannot calculate MELF in a reliable way? Dr. Farrell came up with an alternative solution as well as to looking at the instantaneous flow rate as an alternative. My initial thought was, at what level? Is that a medium flow? Is that a mean flow? So I think there's a little bit of work to do in cases where you cannot apply it. But it's worthwhile looking into.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Then my final set of questions is related to concerns from submitters that Plan Change 7 will cause them to defer investment into upgrades on their farming businesses. And you've addressed this in your reply evidence in a couple of places. In one place, it was specifically in relation to an investment to address climate change. And your response to that was, that's at your reply paragraph 59 and 60, that it's not that long a deferment given everything else that is in train from the Climate Change Commission and so forth. Is that a sort of a fair summary of that response?
Correct. I think climate change issues require a long-term approach. If we would bring that into this plan change, it would take us too long to develop actually those provisions and have them supported by suitable information. It would kind of make the purpose obsolete, probably.
Yeah. So, and then just on this topic of investment, if we look back at the period leading up to 2021, when many of these permits and privileges expired, there has been, leading up to that point, and there's a lot of detail in the evidence, significant investment on some farms into their infrastructure, correct, despite the fact their permits or consents were expiring in 2021. You're aware of that?
I am aware of that, yeah.
And possibly a reason for that is that there wasn't a clear message in the planning framework to be cautious about investment in that context.
Well, the planning framework, one of the issues, and I hope I addressed that appropriately in my evidence, or I have addressed that, is that our current planning framework, especially policy 642A, in combination with the policy on duration, creates the expectation that what you've been using in the past, you will be able to continue to access for long term. The NPSFM clearly now put some caveats around that in terms of where a resource is over-allocated or degraded. Mm. So there's a disjunct, and in order to transition to a new plan that gives effect to the NPSFM, thought it would be prudent to include that in the plan change as well.
Yep, and you explain in your paragraph 60 in your reply evidence that one of the intentions behind PC7 is to caution against further investment in water use.
Yeah.
So you're not shying away from that. That is one of the intentions that sits behind
yes.
it.
Yes, yeah.
And in terms of any relevance that the NPS has and what weight can be given to people's desire to invest and being frustrated from investing for a period of time, there's probably only one or two provisions in the NPS that I want to take you to that might be relevant to that consideration. The first is policy 15. CB674. So policy 15, communities are enabled to provide for their social, economic and cultural wellbeing in a way that is consistent with this national policy statement. So that enablement of those wellbeings, that's the only policy you can really look at when you're considering what weight to give to this issue of deferment of investment, isn't it?
Correct.
And any weight that you do give to that has to be, it's qualified, but it's in a way that's consistent with this NPS. So it's qualified by the, you know, the three priorities of Te Mana o Te Wai.
Correct.
Yeah. Yep. And even when you get into the real nuts and bolts in the NPS, down at 316 and 317. Which is about 316 is setting environmental flows and levels, and 317 identifying take limits. Now, I know we're not applying these provisions now, but those provisions make no reference to even existing investment, let alone future investment, do they? They're not relevant to the setting of limits and flows and takes.
Well, no. I think the NPS is quite clear that you've got to apply Te Mana o Te Wai and the three priorities in setting these limits.
That's right. Thank you, ma'am. No further questions.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Many of the issues that I was proposing to traverse have been covered by my friends, so we won't be particularly long. Have you got your evidence in chief there, Mr. DePelsmaker? Can you go to paragraph 371? 371. Is that better? Now, this is your reasoning for not
supporting an extension of irrigation in consents, correct? And your reasoning behind that, if I read this correctly, is that we haven't done the NPS compliant water quality work yet. So there are areas in Otago where reductions may be required in order to meet the requirements in relation to water quality.
That's correct.
And we don't know, those processes haven't been run, so we don't know what those reductions might be.
That is correct.
So in some places everything might be fine and we can carry on as we are. Some places it might be status quo, but some cases might need a reduction.
That is correct.
And while that is the case, we don't want further investment in irrigation in case that investment becomes lost because of a necessitated reduction in discharges of nutrients.
That is correct. When I read the evidence pointed that it is possible to have no increase in adverse effects, but I was wondering what if you need to actually claw back on contaminant discharges. So that is actually the reason why.
I was really referring, because what I wanted to do was put to you the reason why you changed your mind and just explore that a little bit with
yes.
you. So that was your position in your evidence in chief.
Correct.
And now in your reply evidence, you've considered the evidence particularly of Dr. Crystal?
Correct.
And he says that we can actually increase the amount of irrigable area and in some cases reduce the effects.
Correct.
And based on that evidence, you have reached the view that that we can create a rule which provides for a reduction in environmental effects as being okay to get consent on a restricted discretionary basis?
Correct.
Now, what the point I want to put to you is that the requirement for a reduction, that may still not meet, given that there's no quantum on that, and it could be a small reduction or a large reduction. If we have a catchment which is over-allocated and requires a significant reduction in nutrients to become NPFM compliant, you might end up with a mismatch. Can I explain what I mean
yeah.
by a mismatch? Which the mismatch is that you've got an irrigator who has decided they want to do some more irrigation, they want to increase the area, and they've made an effort to reduce their losses to the most extent they reasonably can.
Correct.
And then they've got their consent, and then you get an NPS compliant framework which requires an increased reduction in losses. That's a plausible situation?
That is a plausible, yeah.
And in that situation, isn't that the risk you refer to in your evidence in chief at 371?
Well, the restricted discretionary activity tries to achieve, again, that we're not having a worse effect, and also consents granted under that rule, the recommended amendment, the restricted discretionary rule, would be for 6 years, which would allow you to review that activity relatively short term.
But isn't the problem that you've allowed this activity to commence on the basis that it's done the most it can to reduce its environmental footprint, but that might not be enough to meet your NPS compliant one, in which case the very risk you talked about in 371 hasn't actually been addressed. The risk being the risk that the investment will be lost because the irrigation equipment won't be able to be used.
That is correct. I guess the key concern, though, was that people that have already committed to an investment, that they would go for the non-complying rule and would get a consent for a longer duration. So the plan change itself, it tries to discourage investment. We don't actually, it's an implicit consequence of the plan change, and intentional, but we don't yeah, we
Can I interpret your answer for you, and you can let me know if it's right? We've got these levers, which is the controlled activity is the lever we want to make as easy as possible, and the key determinant of that is term, the six-year term.
Yep.
So you're effectively, you're, in terms of your two levers, you're adding a lever to the term one, which is restricted discretionary, to make the lever of non-complying more less palatable.
Yes. That is the intention, yeah.
That is the intention, okay. Now, in relation to the way in which you've drafted this provision, you refer to a reduction in environmental effects.
Correct.
Now, an increase in irrigation can have a range of adverse effects on the environment, can't it?
Yes.
It could have an adverse effects on landscape?
Possibly.
It could have adverse effects on terrestrial ecology if that involved the clearance of areas which was currently indigenous vegetation.
Correct,
these are just possible adverse effects. It could have adverse effects on water quality.
Yes.
And those could manifest in a variety of ways. You could have nutrient discharge going through groundwater into surface water.
Mm-hmm.
You could have E. coli making its way into surface water. And then when you talk about the effects being reduced, are you talking about... So if we say there's a suite of potential adverse effects in relation to increased irrigation, is the reduction in relation to all of them or just one of them? So if you had a... Was the intention behind your drafting that you could balance these effects to achieve an overall reduction, or was it that you had to achieve a reduction in each one?
It would be the full suite of environmental effects and not kind of a trade-off.
So the intention is that if it was, for example, in an outstanding or an important landscape, that it would reduce the effects on landscape, which doesn't really make sense as a concept.
That would be also like referring to a landscape matters could potentially be under a district plan as well, so would not directly be applicable to the matters that you control to your water plan.
So the intention in this is not to address, when you talk about adverse effects of landscape, you're not referring to adverse effects of irrigation, you're not referring to landscape.
Given that this is part of a water plan, I would assume that any ecological effects would pertain to that realm of the water plan.
Right. So when you're talking about environmental effects, you're only referring to environmental effects on water quality or quantity.
Yes.
And then if we had the situation where we had a potential increase in an improvement in for example water quantity because you were taking less water because you were being more efficient, but an increase in relation to one but not all of them, you would fail your test.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. I've got no further questions.
Mm-hmm. Just whilst we're there, I'll just cover off a question which arose really in relation to what Mr. Anderson had to say and also what... Ms. Baker Galloway had to say, when we're talking about effects on water quantity, water quality, did you mean to include or capture those activities which evidently are permitted under the water plan? And so Ms. Baker Galloway took you to rules in Chapter 12 to do with the discharge of nutrients, etc.
These are not captured by Plan Change 7?
No.
No.
So when we're talking about no effect on water quality, those activities which are permitted under the rules that Ms. Baker Galloway took you to, you wouldn't be looking for an improvement there. Those activities are permitted. You wouldn't be looking to exercise the lever and start to lift the game in terms of nutrient application and controls.
The framework does not alter how those rules apply.
Yes, I'm just trying to, that was the point of my questioning, and I think the other questioning of Council, what do you mean environmental effects? I mean, it's easy to say, but what's actually in your mind? Is it stuff which is permitted? Are you meaning to capture stuff which otherwise is permitted in the plan or not? What's the broad range here? You're going to think about this overnight because you're coming back tomorrow by the look of it.
I know, and we had the discussion yesterday as well, Your Honour, and I acknowledge that, as I said yesterday, there might be an opportunity to sharpen up those provisions.
Okay, good. All right. So we are with... Who are we with?
Welsh.
Oh, Rugg. No, Mr. Welsh. Yep.
Sorry, Mr. DePalsmaker. It just carries on, one lawyer after another.
It's all good. It's all good.
I would say that typically at this time of day, it's the counsel that gets in trouble with the bench rather than the witness. So you might be on safe ground. I just want to pick up some of your answers to questions that Ms. Dixon posed you. And Ms. Dixon's series of questions were largely aimed at suggesting to you that the council may have lost sight of a quick and simple and cheap plan change. And really, what are we dealing with in the context of hydro? And she put to you about the Waipori scheme, which is one of the larger takes or activities in the Tairi, and said that the consents for those don't come up for renewal again until 2038. And you said aspects of that, and then Ms. Dixon left that for me to follow up. What do you understand as to be the outstanding consents for the Waipori scheme in Tairi?
My recollection, and I'm sorry if I have it wrong, but the Waipori scheme operates on operates on a number of deemed permits, which are going to expire now. But at the same time, I think it was in Ms. Foran's evidence, she hinted at another suite of consents that would be, for which they would lodge applications, I think, in 18 years' time, yes.
In what, sorry?
18 years'
yes.
time? Yeah.
I'll put this to you and see if you agree. That, what Ms. Foran was relating to, was when the Waipori scheme and Deep Stream, which is associated with it, are up for their next renewal. The Environment Court granted consents in 2001.
That is, yeah.
And they're up for renewal in 2038. And what we're talking about for Waipori in the deemed permits are 7 deemed permits. You had heard I mentioned that to the court yesterday, which Mr. Mitchell says contributes only 5% of the Waipori inflows. Do you recall that?
What you said or what Mr. Mitchell
both,
said?
Both, I suppose.
Both.
Fair question. Yeah.
Yes, I recall both.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just for the record, if I suggest to you that the Peiro and Patearoa scheme, which is in the Maniatoto and also owned by Trustpower, those consents don't expire until 2038. You'd have no 2034. You'd have no reason to disagree with that, would you?
No.
No. I wonder. I'm not going to try and do amendments to the clauses by committee today. I'm going to try and focus on some of the higher order documents and just take a step back first and look at the Skelton report.
Yes.
Which is the sort of genesis for this whole plan change. And Professor Skelton doesn't, to be fair to say, wouldn't it, that he doesn't really address hydro at all. He mentions Trustpower's 96 permits that it intends to surrender, and that's the extent of his assessment of hydro. Would that be fair in terms of your recollection?
So. That's my recollection, yeah.
And the limited consideration of hydro and the MPS on renewable energy generation. That limited assessment has flowed through to the Section 32 report, hasn't it, where there was only 10 lines dedicated to that issue and no assessment of any of the policies or objectives of the MPS?
That is correct.
And in the key issues report, those 10 lines are reduced to 9 lines. And it seems to be that the key message from both the Section 32 report and the key issues report is that the MPS REG is not given effect to, but a framework's provided. Is that a fair summation of those two documents as they relate to hydro?
That is correct, and that is quite intentional. As I probably have said before, the intention to provide for a framework for hydro is to incorporate that in the Land and Water Plan.
Yeah, and I'll come to that in a moment. And would it be fair to say that the drafting of the plan change has essentially had at the forefront of its mind irrigation consents? And I'll give you an example. The notified version of the schedule was entitled Methodology for Calculating Assessed Actual Usage of Surface Water Takes for Irrigation Purposes.
I agree to the letter that was initially in there, and I recommended to change that. The issues that Professor Skelton alluded to, one of them, and a key one, is the inadequacy of the water plan to deal with allocation, and that includes a wider range of uses, not just irrigation.
Yes. And one of the inadequacies of the water plan you would accept is that it does not give effect to the MPS REG, does it?
There is very little reference to hydroelectricity generation, except
that's in respect of the Waitaki.
Yes, that's the only one. Yep.
Yes, so you would accept with the general proposition it doesn't give effect to the MPS. And your answers to Ms. Dixon appeared to me, at least, to suggest that we'll kick the can on giving effect to that higher order document in the new plan.
Correct.
And that would represent, would it not, some 10 years, circa 10 years, after the Regional Council was required under the MPS to give effect to that MPS in the regional plan?
Correct.
Yes. And Plan Change 7 perpetuates this, does it not? Because it doesn't contain any references to renewable generation at all.
Correct.
Yeah. I just want to talk to you and clear up something around Mr. Wilson's evidence, which I didn't put to him because, A, I wasn't here in the morning when it was decided we weren't crossing him. But it is probably a planning matter. And Mr. Wilson opined that hydro takes are consumptive because of the definition in the water plan, which uses the definition from Regulation 4 of the water takes and reporting regs. Mm. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Yes. But that's not quite the entire story, is it? The water plan also treats hydro in the same sense of as other non-consumptive takes.
It does describe that, but I personally don't believe that that description matches the description or the definition of non-consumptive in the regulations.
No, but policy, the explanation for policy 632 makes it clear that hydro is categorised with non-consumptive takes. You'd accept that?
I accept that. Okay. It currently describes that, yes.
And Mr. Henderson, he described the Clutha system, or the Clutha scheme, one of the largest in the country, as also being non-consumptive in his evidence in chief at paragraph 23, didn't he?
He did, yes.
But in any event, whether it's consumptive or not consumptive, you would accept that the MPS reg doesn't distinguish, or it applies to both consumptive water takes for the purposes of the regulations and non-consumptive water takes, provided they are for renewable energy, electricity generation, doesn't it?
My recollection from reading it is that there's no distinction, yeah.
Yeah. And notwithstanding that, one of your key intended goals of Plan Change 7, you've stated in a number of times in your evidence, is to discourage further investment in water-dependent economic sectors, isn't it? And that reference is to one of your quotes at 393 of your evidence in chief.
Yes.
Yes. Do you consider hydro generation to be a water-dependent economic sector?
Yes.
Yes. And in your summary, you made a slight and subtle change to that language, in that in paragraph 4D you said one of the methods that Plan Change 7 transitions to a sustainable management of fresh water is by discouraging further investment in irrigation expansion. So you narrowed it down to irrigation expansion.
I believe so.
Yeah. But you still stand by that one of the purposes of this plan change is to discourage investment in water-dependent economic sectors, including hydro.
My reading from the NPS renewable energy generation, especially the preamble which I refer to, is that it might be best to reference or to read it out loud, that the NPS does not apply to the allocation and prioritization of fresh water, as these are matters for regional councils to address in a catchment or regional context and may be subject to the development of national guidance in the future. So what I'm getting at is that even with activities such as hydro, which are provided for through an NPS, we still need to make sure that that is undertaken in accordance with the priorities set in the NPS fresh water management.
Sure.
And be able to have those activities operating in accordance with a regime that gives effect to the NPS freshwater.
Sure, but we're not in a full allocation hearing for a plan change, are we?
We are not.
We're not. And the court is sitting instead of the regional council. And I think Mr. Moore accepted that the NPS does apply. Have you approached that the NPS is of no relevance to Plan Change 7?
NPS renewable energy.
Yes, sorry, I'll move on to FM later. It's too hard with all the acronyms at this time of day. So
it is relevant. It is relevant.
It is relevant.
Yep.
Okay. And the relevance, or the application of that relevance, seems to me in your evidence that you suggest that whilst we don't give effect to the NPS REG in Plan Change 7, we provide a framework. Is mm-hmm. that your fancy two-step?
That's the intent, yeah.
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 And so I just want to look at that. So the framework in Plan Change 7 is the same framework for hydro as it is for every other application for water take, isn't it?
That is correct.
Yeah. And that framework operates to actively discourage investment in renewable electricity generation and other water-related economic sectors, doesn't it? Accepted that.
Again, caution applied because of the need to sort out allocation issues and water management issues.
And that framework for hydro applies a schedule that Mr. Mitchell has will give evidence on, has provided a statement, that the schedule will result in lost generation and inefficient use of the resource.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
is that...
That is correct.
Yes.
But also in my evidence in reply, I have indicated that there might be an opportunity to look at how to how the schedule applies. The intent of the schedule is to claw back
yes.
on paper allocation, not to restrict actual use or historic use.
Yes, in your reply at 124 you've said it may be appropriate if there were to be demonstrated that the application of Schedule 4A, 10-4A, would significantly impact the continued operation and viability of what you call HEG schemes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, is there an applicable planning document that provides recognition for renewable energy generation is there an applicable statutory planning document providing that recognition of renewable electricity generation is only necessary if it's demonstrated that the planning framework would significantly impact on the continued viability and operation of the scheme?
I think that is basically the NPS renewable energy generation that you're referring to. Am I correct?
No, this is your test.
Sorry.
This is your test. In your evidence in chief at paragraph 124, you've suggested you're willing to reconsider the application of the schedule if Trustpower, I presume it's Trustpower, can demonstrate to you that the schedule will significantly impact the continued operation and viability of
yeah.
the scheme in question, of Waipori scheme.
Yeah.
Now I'm asking you, where did you get that test? Are you aware of any planning document that says one only needs to take into account the NPS on renewable energy if it can be demonstrated that there'd be such an effect on it?
Sorry, maybe it's the time of day, but I'm really struggling
maybe
with
the question.
Yeah.
I'm really asking you, where have you come up with this test that it's necessary for Trustpower to demonstrate to you that the schedule will have a significant impact on its continued operation and viability before you'll reconsider the application of the schedule? And I'm asking you, where did you get that test from? Is there a planning document?
No, there is no such planning document, no.
No, that's where I was getting to.
Do you need to take a break, to be fair? I mean, you've been on the stand all day.
I'll see how I go. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, Mum, it might speed things up. I don't know. But
sorry?
It may speed things up if he takes a moment. Maybe it's
well,
the question.
Well, no, I was actually thinking a recess overnight if the witness is tired and, you know, you should be.
Sorry.
Because you've been on deck all day. Yeah. And there's
I'm okay.
Apologise.
No.
Yeah. I'm okay. Yeah, I was just... I think what you hear and what you have in your mind
yeah.
is sometimes different.
Mm.
Well, I only get one go at this, so...
Yeah, no.
No, there's no criticism anywhere.
Yeah, I'd like to know if we are...
It's been a very long day.
Yeah, I'd like to know if we are recessing because I've got a hotel to find and some
flights
to rearrange.
How long do you need to finish your question?
Oh, I've got a fair way to go, Mum.
You've still got a fair way to go?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it is what it is. Like, the children... won't care that I'm not home. The dogs may, but the children may not. So
well,
I am happy to go a bit further.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, but okay.
Are you happy for me to respond to your question?
I think you did. You said no. There was
no planning document. Yeah.
Yeah. Mum, I'm in your hands. Do you want to proceed?
I will continue if you're okay.
I am okay, yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Placemaker, I just want to suggest to you that some of the... placing such a high bar in respect of the schedule where the expert evidence from Mr. Mitchell is the schedule doesn't work and will have... effects that are directly contrary to what the NPS is seeking. I wonder how much of that comes down to your desire to hold the line, a term that you've used repeatedly in the last couple of days.
Yeah. Well, there's two matters, really. One is you refer to the evidence of Mr. Mitchell,
yes,
which demonstrates that there are shortfalls in terms of what would be allocated under new consent would be less in some cases. I have other evidence provided by other witnesses, Mr. Leslie in particular, who considers that there is generally a good level of agreement between historic use and what is generated by the schedule. As a planner, I'm trying to kind of evaluate which one should I give weight
right.
on.
Well,
that is where...
Maybe if you approach it this way, the only rebuttal evidence or reply evidence filed by the council in respect of Mr. Mitchell was that by your data analyst, Mr. Wilson, who commented on two aspects. One, outages, mm-hmm. where he suggested, well, yeah. if there's missing data and there's an outage, well, tough, you don't go controlled, you go restricted discretionary. Yeah. And the other aspect we've already covered, which was consumptive, non-consumptive. But Mr. Henderson, you're the council's hydrologist, and Mr. Leslie don't provide that counterbalance to Mr. Mitchell's expert advice. There's no other expert advice on the matters Mr. Mitchell gives evidence on.
Yeah.
So do you accept that?
I do, yes.
Okay. In respect of drinking water, you also state at 112 of your reply statement that you consider that matter of better providing for drinking water supplies as a complex one.
Yes.
And you have not yet fully consolidated your views on the matter around drinking water.
Yes.
Yes. Given what we've talked about and what's been stated about hydro, is it fair to characterise that issue in the same respect for hydroelectricity, that it's complex and you haven't fully consolidated your views around how we deal with hydro?
In both cases, in my opinion, it can be best dealt with within the framework, making sure either through the method or through the rules that the method does not impede on or does not claw back on actual use. In terms of drinking water, the NPS is quite clear that it's a higher priority use, but a higher priority use compared to third priority uses, not compared to mono or to Y.
We'll come back to the hierarchy yeah. of uses in a moment. So is that fair to say then that you're still to consolidate your views around hydro in terms of how it is appropriately provided for in Plan Change 7?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, I'm coming now to, when I talk about the NPS now, I should largely be talking about the freshwater management.
NPS.
NPS,
yep.
yeah. So you've confirmed in your evidence in chief and reply that Plan Change 7 does not, nor does it seek to, give full effect to the NPS FM.
Correct.
But the approach taken in Plan Change 7 has been to give full effect, or to give effect to the NPS FM to the extent it can. That's right?
Correct.
And in some parts, as we've gone through the last 2 days, probably more accurate that you're inviting the court to give effect through Plan Change 7 to parts of the NPS FM. Because at the moment it doesn't fully achieve that, does it? As much as it can reasonably,
yes,
practically
yeah.
do. Okay, I want to look at a couple of the policies that you've mentioned them insofar as setting them out, but haven't provided an analysis of those. And the first one is policy 4. And policy 4 reads, freshwater is managed as part of New Zealand's integrated response to climate change.
Correct.
Doesn't it?
Yep.
and you would accept that hydro generation is clearly an important part or important in the context of the nation's response to climate change, isn't it?
Correct.
But it's fair to say, is it not, that the approach of Plan Change 7 is to kick the climate change can, too much alliteration at this time of day, down the road to the new regional plan?
Correct.
Because it's silent on giving effect to Policy 4, isn't it? Plan Change 7.
Correct.
Yeah. Similarly, Policy 15, which Ms Baker put to you. Communities are enabled to provide for their social, economic and cultural well-being in a way that is consistent with this NPS. Electricity generation is important in that context of well-being too, isn't it?
Correct. It's important, but I also read this policy as policy 15 requires all other policies to be met. You need to still comply with all others. It's not a pick and choose one. Yeah.
No, I understand that, although Plan Change 7 is picking and choosing, isn't it?
In what sense?
In the sense that it doesn't deal with the NPS
RNG,
and it doesn't deal with all the policies that could give effect to now. Mm-hmm. And you haven't provided any analysis on Policy 15 in your statement of evidence, have you?
No.
No. Now, I want to come to the order of hierarchy, and your answer just before suggests that may suggest a reason for that. The third order priority in the NPS FM relates to the ability of people and communities to provide for their social, economic and cultural well-being now and in the future, doesn't it?
Correct.
And you consider, is it fair to say, you consider renewable electricity generation to be in that third order priority under the NPS?
It is not that simple. Reading the NPS, the NPS is quite silent on it, except it makes a distinction. It's not really a distinction, but it does provide for some hydroelectricity schemes to be included in an appendix, I believe. One of them being the Clutha.
Yep.
And so it provides an exemption for those, but not for others.
Yeah, but that's in terms of attributes, isn't it?
Yes.
Those five schemes are described as the five largest, and they have a free pass or less of an obligation when it comes to attributes. What I'm talking about is the order of priority.
Yeah.
And I'm wanting to know from you whether you consider renewable electricity generation to be a third order priority.
Yes.
Yeah. And the second order of priority relates to the health needs of people. And in its brackets, such as drinking water, doesn't it?
Yes.
And you state in your evidence, in chief at 342, that water takes for drinking water are a second order priority.
Yes.
Yes. Do you accept that water takes for electricity generation are also a second order priority under the NPS FM?
In my opinion, it's within the third category.
All right. Well, let's have a look at that. The NPS second order refers to health needs of people and then uses the word specifically, such as drinking water. So would you accept that the word such as means that drinking water is an example of something that is a health need of people? It's a
yes.
Such as rather than an IE.
Yep.
And so that would suggest, would it not, that such as, or that list of drinking water by the use of the word such as, is not an exhaustive list.
Correct.
And it being the MPS, clearly contemplates that there may be other health needs of people, doesn't it?
Correct.
Beyond drinking water. And do you accept that the electricity generation is critical to people's health?
It contributes, but is it critical? Again, I still think that it's, in my opinion, and it's just one opinion, the health needs refers to drinking water, as well as things such as availability of water for hygiene purposes. I had not anticipated hydro to be in that category.
Yes, but it may be. Would you accept that?
It may be, according to,
Yeah, well, according to the authors of the Section 32 evaluation report for the MPS freshwater management, have you had an opportunity to read that Section 32 analysis?
Bits of it.
And those authors noted in respect of policy 4 at page 46. And Mum, this isn't in the common bundle, but I have some hard copies, but I'll read the quote anyway. Contributes, this is talking about policy 4, it contributes to achieving the objective of 211B, which is the health needs, and C, by preserving hydroelectricity flexibility, which will secure renewable electricity generation, which is important for meeting the health needs of people, clause B, as well as enabling communities to provide for their social, cultural, economic well-being now and into the future, clause C. So my question is, do you accept that it is open for a finding that electricity generation, renewable electricity generation, can be a second order and a third order?
On that basis, I stand corrected, yes.
Okay. And does that cause you to reconsider where you think the framework for hydroelectricity should be in Plan Change 7 as a second order priority?
Not really, because still it is subordinate to the first order one, and that is looking after the health and well-being of water bodies. And it puts it in line with drinking water. And that is how we intended to treat those two activities in Plan Change 7, so in the same manner.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't understand. Are you saying that... I don't understand.
Sorry.
So are you saying that you intended the health needs of people, such as drinking water, and the generation of electricity to be on the same...
They're both captured by Plan Change 7 framework.
They're captured by Plan Change 7 framework, but did you see them as meeting the second part of Objective 2.1 of the MPS in terms of the three priorities?
I agree with Council.
Yeah,
sorry.
So you... yeah, okay, so you put hydro together with drink water as the second priority to be addressed.
Yeah, they are.
Okay, right, I've got you. All right.
Now, I want to talk briefly about Trustpower's relief and the term carve-out has been bandied around a wee bit. Is it fair to say that some of the relief that Trustpower seeks is some specific provisions, or in your language, a framework for renewable electricity generation? Just a different framework.
It is a different framework, yes.
Yes.
It's a suite of provisions from recollection.
And in rejecting or replying to that framework, as set out by Ms. Stiles, you say that it's inappropriate because renewable electricity generation may have significant impacts on the health and well-being of water bodies and other values.
Yes, correct.
Now, you're not for a moment suggesting that the effects associated with Trustpower's four deemed permit applications will generate anything like significant adverse effects, are you? Well, maybe I should put it this way. You're not the processing officer, because you've said several times you're not on consents. You're not the processing officer for those applications, are you?
No, I'm not.
No. And have you reviewed those applications?
No, I based myself on the evidence that was provided by Ms. Stiles and Ms. Foran and Mr. Mitchell.
And none of that evidence identified significant adverse effects associated with those applications, did it?
I cannot recall whether they are specific to the applications, but some of the descriptions in Mr. Mitchell's evidence and Ms. Foran's evidence describe activities that from hydrological or ecological or a cultural perspective would have an adverse effect.
Yeah, there's a difference between having an adverse effect that's relevant, which is anything over de minimis. There's a big difference between something that's greater than de minimis and something that's significant. And my question is, you're not suggesting, are you, that the Trustpower applications for these deemed permits will generate significant adverse effects, having not seen them?
It would be hard to make that assessment, yep.
Yeah, so it'd be hard to stand by your assertion that they may have significant adverse effects.
Correct.
Okay, in terms of the plan change, let's assume that there are applications out there that do have significant adverse effects. Is it your view that providing a consenting pathway with no ability to decline such an application for up to with a 6-year term is appropriate?
Is that the...
I've turned it around. So I'm saying, assume that there are some applications out there that do generate significant adverse effects. Given the consenting pathway that Plan Change 7 provides of a 6-year controlled activity provision, would that be appropriate to have no ability to decline that activity, even though it generates significant adverse effects for at least a period of 6 more years?
Well, in the context that it would be for a period of no more than 6 years.
Together with 1, 2, 4, it could be longer than 6 years, couldn't it? Applications may take a year to process and be granted through the process, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're quite comfortable with a significant adverse effect on a deemed permit carrying on for at least 6 more years?
Yes, but I would not want to stretch it too much beyond the 6 years.
All right. You, in fact, acknowledge that under Plan Change 7 there could be some worse outcomes environmentally than what could eventuate if they were, if an application were processed in a sense assessed against the operative plan.
Are you in reference to Schedule 10A, I believe? I have, based on some assessments that were done by Mr. Leslie, we identified that while the rate of take would be, while the methodology takes away paper allocation, you could end up with rates of take that are slightly higher than what would be granted under the practice that is currently carried out to give effect to the operative plan.
I suppose, Mum, I only got about four more questions.
So oh, I know I've got the lot. Sorry. Where's this going? Are we talking about dams? Or are we talking about, you know, throwing it open now to all activities?
I'm not talking about dams at all.
Oh, okay. Hydro. Sorry.
I was just
hydro.
Wanting to know.
Yeah.
The witness in his reply evidence indicated it wasn't appropriate to provide for the relief of that trespass seeks because it could generate significant adverse effects.
Yeah.
But the reality is the framing framework, planning framework that the council has put up specifically, it could enable an effect that is significant with no ability to decline that.
Well, it may enable something significant, certainly might enable increased effects. That's the, well, yeah.
Well, my point
change
is that,
with subsequent effect, with the significance of the effect, I don't know. But anyway, this what this plan change is not doing is avoiding effects, nor reducing them. It's rolling them over. Yeah.
Now, one of the other reasons that you consider that specific provisions for sought by trust power are not appropriate is because there is a need to take a longer term perspective on the impacts of climate change on freshwater bodies. Mm-hmm. You do that at 123B. Do you appreciate the irony in citing climate change as a reason against providing for relief on hydroelectricity?
Well, I think there's two aspects to it. One is climate change helps in a response. Sorry, hydroelectricity helps in responding to climate change and helps with resilience of communities, but at the same time, hydroelectricity can be affected as well by climate change, specifically the supply of water that is needed to support hydroelectricity generation. So given that you have a variety of uses, how we're going to deal with the impacts of climate change on flows and what that means for allocating water to different uses is something we need to sort out in the land and water plan. Mm. That is where my, that is where it was coming from.
All right. Two more questions. On the topic of climate change, at paragraph 150 of your evidence in chief, you set out the section, relevant section 7 matters, but you have, well, the most relevant, but one of the only two section 7 matters you omit is 7J, which is the benefits to be derived from the use and development of renewable energy. Was that an oversight, or do you think 7J has no particular relevance to Plan Change 7?
I did not include it because we are not specifically providing provisions in Plan Change 7 for hydroelectricity generation.
Okay. And is that the same reason why you excluded or omitted objectives and policies in sections 4.2 and 4.4 of the RPS relating to climate change and renewable electricity generation, respectively?
Correct.
Correct. Okay. Thank you. Mum?
Thank you.
I think I've stolen a few moments, but thank you.
No, that's okay. When I say we're rolling over the effects, I guess that just it depends somewhat on whether this is a process-orientated plan change or process and environmental plan change. And it's not clear what the outcome there will be. Okay. Suggest we do take the break because suspect you're probably quite tired, having been at this all day. I had thought Mr. Reid would get to you tonight, but unless we had any confidence you'd finish in 10 minutes, I think we'll hear tomorrow.
I've had a discussion with my friend Mr. Page. He's raising most of the issues that I was going to discuss. The remaining issues that I had related to the schedule, which is being dealt with via the separate process anyway. And the only other point I was going to question this witness about was related to the restricted discretionary pathway. That's already been canvassed extensively. I did have my own client scenario to put to this witness, but I'm not sure. It probably doesn't really add anything. That they're a vineyard. The sort of scenario that my learned friend Mr. Anderson was putting to the witness sounded more as like a dairy conversion type expansion scenario, whereas my client's dealing with a small expansion of their existing vineyard, which they've already committed to. So that was the only matter that I really wanted to raise with the witness. But I'm really content. I'd like to get away this evening.
Come back tomorrow.
Well, I'd like to.
We'll finish tonight. That's what I'm asking.
I'd like to finish tonight so that I can get away.
Okay, so just on that small matter, and otherwise Mr. Page is going to pick up the balance of matters that you're interested in. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honour.
Hopefully. How long do you reckon you need?
Oh, just a few moments.
Okay, right.
So, Mr. Pelsmaker, Mr. Anderson questioned you, I think, about how you'd got to your position regarding the restricted discretionary pathway, and I think you it's really a recognition that for those who have committed already committed to an expansion, they've already taken the financial risk that you're seeking to avoid with the plan change in part. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, as I said to Her Honour, the scenario that Mr. Anderson painted sounded as though he was getting at a dairy conversion or a pivot conversion or something of that nature. So I'm just going to put to you the scenario that my clients are facing. So they have an existing, they are an existing series of vineyards on the Minyahera Care Scheme, and they are, so they're located nearby to Alexandra, and they have been developing their vineyard since 2002, throughout the 2000s since then. They initially established their infrastructure, piping, storage, on the basis that it would irrigate a certain hectareage, and they haven't quite fit, they haven't got to that number, but they have always planned to do so. So I just want you to assume, for current purposes, that they would be able to show that they they'd be able to meet your criteria in terms of the rule relating to existing discretionary restricted discretionary activity. So that's your 10A31A
one
B
yep
2, 1, 2, and 3. So one, they would be so they have already committed to the infrastructure. Two, that they would be able to show an existing efficient an improvement in efficient use because they're using the same amount of water over a larger area. And then with three, what they might be able to show and just for the purposes of discussion, they might be able to show that they had no additional effects on the environment. So really the status quo, water quality-wise, landscape-wise, whatever. So isn't that exactly the sort of scenario that you would want to encourage into the restricted discretionary pathway as against them going through a non-complying?
Correct, yes.
And so the issue there, though, is that is the issue that Her Honour discussed with you this morning, which is what is meant by the notion of an improvement or a reduction in environmental effects, and whether that's really necessary in the context of this plan change.
Well, it's two notions. What are the reduction and what are the environmental effects?
Yes.
Yeah, what's any of that mean?
Well, it begs the question as to what it does mean, Your Honour, yes. Yeah. But, so my real proposition is this the sort of scenario that the witness would see a benefit from encouraging into the restricted discretionary pathway as opposed to the non-compliant?
Well, yeah, but you haven't told me what effects your clients will be working on, and this is a critical issue. Neither has this witness.
Yes.
And so this, you know, is it the effects that I put to the witness in the morning, which I thought the broad answer was yes, but now it's an answer no, if those effects are, you know, otherwise covered by a permitted activity rule, which is virtually everything apparently in Otago. What effects are left to be managed under this rule? It's actually a really big issue, and we have no clarity. So when you say effects, what do you mean? What's left over that's not permitted?
Well, I'm just working on the basis of the rule, Your Honour. I'm not sure what it means.
I don't, neither do I. Yeah, and it's really important, and I do think perhaps he needs to sleep on it. Think about it. It's actually huge.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you can ask him, but I think it's huge.
Well, I can't. Your Honour, I can't take it any further, I don't think. It's an issue that, whether sleeping on it helps, it's something that needs to be given some consideration.
Yeah.
I don't know whether this witness is going to be, whether questions about the topic are really going to be able to solidify that issue. It needs clarity, I think, about in terms of a written rule about what is exactly meant.
Yeah. And when you say your clients are committed, do you mean the infrastructure is already in ground and purchased on the land?
Yes.
Yeah,
it's really a question of storage. So the dams that are there and the piping network, and that's already in place.
It's already in place. Yes. It's just that they haven't actually irrigated this block and would like to now.
Quite, yeah. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's largely done but not quite finished.
Yeah, so it's not a conditional contract to purchase subject to getting a water permit or anything like that. Yeah, no, I understand. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, all I had, Your Honour.
All right.
Yes.
Perhaps we will think about that overnight because this is really big. I don't know how it was covered off in the Section 32, but this is huge. Yeah, what you mean or don't mean. I don't know. I mean, there's also a question whether this is something you can do by yourself, which isn't, I'm not asking you to confer with other people, but yeah, it's almost got an implementation theme to it too. In other words, what your consents team are thinking about. Well, how would they actually implement this policy? And it very much could be something which might be referred to conferencing if there is merit. And I can certainly see it from your client's point of view. Infrastructure is already in the ground, on the ground. So it's not as if you're talking about have made inquiries or have a conditional contract. It's not that.
No, it's not.
It's actually already existing. Yeah. And, you know, and so, and again, that's really important. So what was this meant to cover? People like yourself, at least? Or was it meant to cover somebody, you know, on the other end that, has been working towards putting in new infrastructure? It's not in the ground. It's not on the ground. It's yet to... it will not be committed to until there's a water permit or, you know, a renewal of the water permit. Is it meant to cover then? I don't know. Is that sufficient commitment? I don't know. It sounds like lots of discretion in that restricted discretionary rule. Yeah.
I take your point, Your Honour.
And that's actually a consent team sort of question too, isn't it? It's actually, what would they make of it?
So my suggestion, Your Honour, is that the council formulates a considered position on it, perhaps in writing, comes back to the court, and gives the parties an opportunity to comment on that.
Yeah. What do you think, Mr. Moore?
Homework.
Well, not necessarily overnight either. I'm just wondering if we finish with Mr. Page's questions, release the witness from his oath.
on the basis he's going to come back, which he is actually going to come back for, you know, anyway. But, you know, start thinking about these issues of this is the policy, that's the consents team, how does this, you know, how does this actually work together?
Yeah, it strikes me if you look at the genesis of this RDA rule, it's a rule put in response to evidence from submitters, so it's not a rule that was assessed in the original Section 32 report.
No.
And where we find ourselves in this exercise has been very helpful in terms of identifying perhaps the breadth of what could be covered in terms of the language. It strikes me that the topic would benefit possibly from some conferencing with parties insofar as they have expert planners who have raised this issue, to which Mr. DePelsmaker is now responding to. But in the alternative, Mr. DePelsmaker being released from his oath following cross-examination to further consider this issue in consultation with those that will be implementing this framework.
Yeah, I really shake it down. In terms of, is his understanding of this policy the same as somebody who would actually implement this policy? Really critical. Not that this policy, actually, the whole package.
Yes, I think there's clarity over what the issue is that the witness is trying to address through this rule. It's just that the way in which the rule responds or seeks to respond appears very broad on its face and uncertain in terms of what environmental effects means and what reduction means in this context.
And who is captured anyway. And whether you need to, or whether you actually stop being so kind and say it's actually a consent, which is where the minister would go. So, you know, that's a...
Well,
do you need an RDA rule for Mr. Reed's client, or can Mr. Reed's client be swept up in the controlled activity rule?
Yes,
I don't know.
It is still a 6-year consent.
Still a 6-year consent.
The RDA consent is.
But he's not been using the water.
Yes, it's the expansion of the irrigation area in the controlled activity rule, which has required a response.
No, I understand that. Okay, well, if you are going into conferencing, it will be, in terms of the pre-conferencing or even pre-mediation work, all parties would need to get themselves, would need to be, you know, revealing, you know, the standard positions. What is the position and why? Council would need to understand what those different positions are and come back with a response. You know, the way that we've been managing the Dunedin Plan and also Southland Plan. Almost just looks like a mediation, actually, when everybody reveals what their positions are and you go, oh, yeah, but... yeah.
Yes, well, it would certainly help, and particularly understanding those parties that had raised this issue. And I'll need to refamiliarise myself with precisely what relief they were seeking and how that fits in terms of where this issue is at present.
Okay. Oh, well, Mr. Page, you might want to push it around a bit more tomorrow or not. But anyway, that seems a sensible way. I'm just saying, you know, if you don't need to pursue it, then obviously don't. But if you want to pursue it to some extent, do. But it sounds like there's an agreement that there needs to be more work done on the RDA rule.
Yes. My clients don't have a particular interest in that rule,
okay.
But we do have an interest in the issue which has given rise to the rule. So I'm going to explore a lot of things tomorrow with Mr. DePelsmaker about what the goal is. Because it seems to me that part of the difficulty with the state of the hearing at the moment is we don't have it clear whether we are just dealing with whether we're dealing with a substantive plan change or whether there's a hybrid in which there are two paths, a procedural path and a substantive path.
I don't know that there's a hybrid, but...
to me the different function of the controlled and the non-complying rule.
Oh, well, no, I think there's pretty much, there's lots of environmental stuff under that control rule too.
I agree. The question is whether there should be.
And that's a question. So it seems to be a hybrid plan. It's not process only. It's process and environmental. Now, here's the issue. Is whether or not this plan change was tested with the consents folks. And they understood it to be
you know, a blend of both process and environmental, and we're content with that. But the policy, in putting your hat on as the policy person, you didn't foresee that there were these substantive environmental things travelling through with some of the in matters of control or restrictions on discretion.
Yeah. Respond to that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So the environmental measures that are in the plan change are there because they are actually mechanisms that are currently in the plan. For example, the clawback on paper allocation, the minimum flows, those are mechanisms that have been set under the current plan. This is a standalone chapter, which means that for activities that deal with, for the replacement of existing permits, we cannot consider other provisions in the plan. Therefore, we brought those into, those critical ones, we brought them into the standalone chapter. Does that make sense?
I think what you're saying, this is a process plan only, where you're trying to remove the paper allocation and cap, if you like, the individual takes.
That is correct.
Takes and volumes. That's your process plan. But your matters of control and matters of discretion
are
substantive environmental concerns.
Yeah.
Did you mean that? Because you've actually said at different times, no, it's process, it's not environmental. But actually, the two seem to be travelling together, and that's the problem of what is the problem we're working on here. And so, you know, you've got a range of responses from folk. Yeah. Mm. So, and with that in mind, did you check with, and is this your drafting? Firstly, is this your drafting for the plan change?
Sorry, can you?
Did you draft the plan change?
It's stated in my evidence, early on in my evidence. The plan change was drafted because we were constrained in time.
No, did you draft it? It's just
No, I did not draft it.
You didn't draft it.
I provided input in the drafting.
Yep, okay.
Yeah. The recommendations, however, in my evidence in chief and in my evidence in reply,
yes, are yours, those. And they've come through. So you've got this plan change. Was this plan change, was it vetted or run by consent?
It was partly developed with consents and relevant bits, and they definitely reviewed it.
I'm not sure where this leads you. Is it a process? Is it environmental? Is it both? Does the court just make a decision on what it is? But it's the key issue, and it has been the key issue since we started. Sorry.
Your Honour, I didn't want to just raise one issue, which is in relation to the new restricted discretionary rule. That, of course, is something that has come in Mr. De Felsenmaker's evidence and reply in response to the evidence of various submissions. Because it was evidence in reply, the Director General does not deal with the restricted discretionary rule. The same is true for many other
And countries. That would be... That's unfortunately, that's the process where you've got this plan change sitting with the court, and it's not your usual exchange evidence and reply evidence. But that's the purpose of cross-examination. And I think, and it's a fair point that you're raising.
If we're going to conferencing, Your Honour, I do want to leave open the opportunity for planners who have not commented on the RDA rule. To still be
and I would have thought that was something in fairness that you could lead from your witness, and if not lead, put on paper. Not that I'm inviting another 2,000 pages of paper, but if in listening to all of this, and there are concerns of the drafting, I mean that can be addressed, not just as a draft, but also in a narrative fashion.
So I just wanted to flag that now, Your Honour.
No, fair enough. And it was flagged in the directions. The opportunity to file supplementary papers was always there. And so, yes, it's there.
you can file it, you just need to let me, you know, just need to flag that that is what you're doing,
That's right.
We can manage that. But I'm not inviting people to put in the breadth of evidence that they have so far. It's working against you, but yeah, and it doesn't need to be that way.
Understood, John.
Yeah. Okay. All right. All right. So where do we get to? We get to this is something that actually needs some serious thought. Yeah, and testing with the consents people. It may be that, you know, you want to carry through with this, but the witness needs more time.
Yes, and that'll be something to explore when the witness has finished this round of examination in terms of where to, but it certainly this process to date has identified some of the issues which weren't necessarily foreseen.
That's always the purpose of the process. Exactly, that's always the process. So, you know, in case people out in the gallery don't know, this is the process. You know, you start a hearing, and then the relief changes and changes again. There's nothing unusual about that. What's unusual about that is actually is the fact that we've got the first instance decision. So that's slightly unusual. Well, that is in fact the first time, and also we're trying to make the process work within the usual procedures of the court. So but we'll get there. Yep.
Yes.
Supplementary evidence is always available. Just have to let me know, and then I have to let Mr. Cooper program it in the back, and he's not listening. More impact on his schedule, I think. Yeah. Okay. So we're adjourned through to 9:30 tomorrow morning, and you remain on your oath. Yeah. Very good.
Paul Rice.